We are down to verse 18, I think. And we are talking about the number of the beast, 666. We've introduced the two beasts, the beast of the sea, the beast of the land. And now we're being admonished by John to have an understanding of the mark of the beast. So that's where we'll take up with chapter 13 and verse 18. Let's begin class this morning with prayer. Steve, would you direct us in prayer, please? Verse 18 says, "This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. Now, if you walked out on the street and you just ask anyone in general of the beast, almost every one of you can probably tell you the number is 666. And if you ask them, what does this mean? Who is 666 or what is 666? You're going to get a different answer from every person. Just as if you ask, you know, who is the Antichrist, you're going to get a different answer from every person because no one knows. It has been suggested that this beast is anyone from Adolf Hitler to Saddam Hussein to now I think it's Putin in Russia. Every time something happens globally, bad, whoever is responsible for it or connected with it is considered to be this person. Now, the number 666, if you go back to the original Latin and Greek languages, you'll find there really is no definition for it. It is believed that as close as we can come, or as close as the scholars can come, the number of the beast is talking about Rome, the emperor, or the power that is of that day. Now, we know that the number has to do with the enemies of God and his people. And we do know that these three enemies, and of course, chapter 13 talks about the dragon himself, and then he talks about the two beasts, the beast of the land, the beast of the sea, that these are definitely enemies of God's people, whose only intent is to destroy the church. Now, the dragon, of course, is Satan. We've already determined that. And we have also determined that the beast of the sea, in all probability, is talking about Rome itself. And that the beast of the land is basically talking about emperor worship, because that's what the beast of the land was holding to, the beast to worship the first beast, which was the beast of the sea, which of course we think is Rome. Now, the number 666, it is a number of imperfection. What is the number of perfection? We talked about that. 7 is the number of perfection. So 6 falls short. It will never be complete. The number of man will never equal the number of God, which is the number of perfection. Satan and his two helpers, as we have read in chapter 13, will never succeed in overpowering God, no matter how hard they try. And they're very fierce and they're very powerful. And as we go back and we read the description of the two beasts, the beast of the land, the beast of the sea, with the multiple heads, the multiple horns, and the power that they have, and the way they were capable of influencing and taking control of the people, yet they can never take control of God. Their war against the saints is also doomed to failure. These three antagonists will never succeed against God's people. Now again, this number, as the scripture says, it is the number of man. Let me just read to you some of the things that I have about the number 666. Some of the suggestions that are given as to what this number means and how it was compiled. Man was created on the sixth day, and after which God rested. Satan confronted man with an attempt to overthrow him from God, to turn him away from God, which he was indeed successful in doing that. We do know that Satan, as he approached Eve, told her that she would be able to be like God. Now, you know, if you can picture yourself in this scenario, you're the only man and woman on earth. The only person or presence that you have ever dealt with is God Himself. And now here comes a fourth entity into this picture. He begins to tell you something that is totally different from that which you have heard in the past. Now, you already have into your mind the awesomeness of God and the fact that God has created everything within your sight, that He has created you Himself, and He has told you certain things about life, and you have no reason to question it. Now, this fourth entity walks into the picture and immediately challenges you to question God. Having never had to deal with anything like this, how would you respond to that? What would be your response to that? The first thing, I think we would probably have done what Eve said. God has said. That's the only thing she knew to say. God has said. Because God is the only person outside of Adam that has spoken with her and has given her instruction. So her response was, God has said. But then she is challenged with this: God is wrong. God is wrong. There is another way. Now you look at God as being perfect. You look as God being complete seven. I want to tell you there's another way. This author is trying to suggest to us that the way of man is just so close to perfection with God that it could almost be conceived as being perfect. Because no doubt when this ran through Eve's mind, she looked at the thought, I could be like God. I could be perfect. And that was appealing to her. So he has brought Eve's thinking up almost to the point where she could be like God Himself. And it was a hard thing for her to overcome, and of course we know that she did not. The three antagonists, as I said, will never succeed against the saints. They failed in telling Eve she could be like God, and of course in reality she couldn't. Therefore they failed. They failed to maintain purity before God. You see, to reach this number seven, this number of perfection, there must be the element of purity involved, because what is God? He is pure. It is something that will never be achieved. They failed to maintain the perfect place to live as their home. Eden, by all description, was the absolute perfect place to be. But yet they failed in maintaining to be able to stay there. Everything that Satan has driven man to do in an attempt to make him think he can be like God, they have failed. So man's number can never reach this number of perfection, the number of seven. Again, we don't know what exactly the number means. I've got a lot of information that I have pulled that goes into the different languages that tries to explain the 666, and I'm not going to go into all of that, because all that is man's speculation as to what it could mean, and there's 100 definitions. The fact is, we do not know. Any comments on that? This is one of those that, you know, I told you when we began this study, there's just going to be some things that I cannot answer. This is one of them. I cannot give you a definite answer to what 666 is. Now, you walk out there, someone's going to tell you, oh, yeah, I know what that is. And they'll give you one of these scenarios. But in reality, we simply do not know. Well, and you know, and that's the point of the whole Bible. Right. And again, that's the theme throughout the Bible. There are so many things about God's Word that we do not know and cannot know. God has told us through the Word everything that we need to know. And if we don't know it, then simply this is God's way of telling us maybe this is something you don't need to know. You remember as a child when you asked your parents why you couldn't do anything, and what did they say?
Just because.
I said so. Exactly. They didn't give you a reason, but they told you what you needed to know, didn't they? Well, this is the way God deals with us. There are some things God says you just simply do not need to know. What I have told you, you need to know, and what I have told you, you need to follow. But there are some things that it's not meant for man to understand. Okay? Questions, comments on that? Any questions on chapter 13 about the two beasts or the dragon before we move on to chapter 14? All right. Well, let's close the book on chapter 13. You know, I told y'all several weeks ago that we'll start moving fast on this. I don't know when that's going to happen, but we will sooner or later. All right, let me pull my notes out here because I've got them here somewhere. Chapter 14 is going to talk about something else. Chapter 14 is going to talk about the Lamb and the 144,000, and we're going to discuss that in length. And then it's going to talk about, the three angels and their proclamations. You know, first of all, we have the Lamb and the 144,000. Now, these 144,000, they have the Father's name written in their foreheads. Now, and again, you know, you really need to understand, as I have said this from the time we began this study, you didn't see 144,000 people walking around with something buried into their foreheads. Okay? This is symbolic. Just like you didn't see an animal with 7 heads and 10 horns walking around. This is all symbolic, and we need to understand that from the very beginning. So please keep that in mind as we go through this study. All right, let's look at verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 through 5. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb. Who's the Lamb? Who? Jesus. And with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who have been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth was no lie was found, for they are blameless. All right. 144,000. When you read this description, basically you're looking at 144,000 male virgins. That's what this is basically saying here. They are given the mark of the Father in their foreheads. Now, John said, I heard a voice from heaven. Now, how many times does he say this in Revelation? He hears stuff all the time, don't he? Now, he's going to say the very same thing that he has been saying throughout this entire book. It was like the voice of many waters. It was like the sound of thunder. Now, what does this tell us? It wasn't waters, and it wasn't thunder. It is something that sounds like thunder and water. As we go throughout this whole book, and I've said this time and time again, this is mental. This is symbolism. It is something that you would address as something like. You know, we've all been told that when a tornado comes through, what does it sound like? A train, a freight train. We all know what a freight train sounds like. You know, I have never heard the sound of a tornado. Claude said one came through, what, 2 nights ago? Close to his house. Did you hear it? Did it sound like a train? Okay. Okay. That's what we hear. So, did that mean that a train came through close to Claude's house? No, it was something that sounded like a train. This is what John is trying to describe for us, the things that he is seeing and hearing. He says, you know, visualize yourself if you were to hear this or if you were to see this. This is what you would think you're seeing and hearing. But that's not really what it is. And he's doing the same thing here. It is the voice of many waters. Now, when you think of many waters, when I think of many waters, I think about Niagara Falls. Now, I've never been to Niagara Falls, but I have seen the videos. And you hear the waters roar, and it's an awesome sound, you know, just hearing it and watching it on TV. So this is, in all probability, something like what John heard. But he didn't hear Niagara Falls, but it was a sound similar to that. And the same thing with the thunder. Is thunder the only thing that sounds like thunder? Not necessarily. There are other things that sound like thunder. Whatever John was experiencing here sounded like thunder. Now, he said something else. John heard the sound of what sounded like harpists playing their harps. All right? And then they were singing a new song. But it was a song that no one could learn. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean their level of understanding was incapable of following a song? Now, you know, we occasionally learn new songs here on Wednesday nights when we have our song service. And, you know, when we start out, we don't know this song. Some of us have never heard this song. But after we hear it a few times, we catch on and we understand it and we are able to sing it. But whatever this was, it was impossible to learn, except for those who had the mark of the Father. They were capable of understanding. They were of the redeemed. Okay? Now. Yeah. Okay? All right. No one could learn the song except the redeemed from the earth. 144,000. Now, you know, a lot of people have taken this particular teaching to say, well, that means that there's only going to be the 144,000 in heaven because they're the only ones that God redeemed. And this is their thinking. I think it's the Latter-day Saints that teach this. Oh, the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's the Jehovah's Witnesses that teach this. The majority of those who are saved will remain on the new earth, and only the 144,000 will actually be able to go to heaven itself. Of course, that's not what Paul teaches. He says we shall all be gathered in the air to be with the Lord forever. And that pretty much refutes that thought. But people take this verse to have you to understand that only the redeemed, which is the 144,000, will actually ever see heaven. No, it does not. either that or they just were able to refrain from human behavior. One of the two. Like I said, that's one of the things that we're not told. Yeah. Okay. So we have the 144,000, which are the first fruits of God and of the Lamb. And they are without fault, it says, before the throne of God, and no guile is found in their mouths. All right. Verses 6 through 13. We're going to read about the angelic proclamations. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." Another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives the mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into a cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their deeds follow them." Okay, we have this event taking place that gives description of coming judgment. It gives description of those who follow the beast, and it gives admonition to those who would remain faithful to God. The first proclamation is by the angel that is telling to preach the gospel to all who dwell on earth. Now, who would be the all that John is writing of here? Who's he talking about? But let's ask this question first. Who is he giving instruction to preach the everlasting gospel? It's us. We're the ones he's talking to. Now, of course, now he's physically talking to the people of the day that he's writing this book to. But, you know, this is for every generation to come. The gospel or the Bible is for every generation to come. So in giving them instructions to remain faithful to God and to preach the Word of God, these same instructions have been given to us. And, you know, it goes hand in hand with what Jesus said when he left earth to go back to the Father. What did he say? "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." What is this angel telling the people here? "Go into the whole world and preach this everlasting gospel to everyone who dwells on the earth." It's the same thing. It's different wording. But the message is the same. God's word is to be taught and received by everyone who dwells on earth. And who can do that other than those who are faithful to God? I mean, we wouldn't expect to hear the gospel from someone out on the street, would we? We're definitely not going to hear the gospel from one who is following the dragon and the beast. They're not going to give you the gospel. They may give you a perverted version of the gospel to simply pull you away from God even farther than you are. But he's talking to the faithful. He says, you teach it to every nation, every tribe, every tongue, and every people. And then he says, fear God. Why? Because the hour of his judgment is coming. Now, John has been preaching this since the beginning of the book of Revelation. It is coming. It is at hand. This is about to come to an end. Now, again, it's just as he told those martyred saints who were under the altar, be patient. It's going to be a little time involved, but it's coming. So endure and be patient. How long do we figure it took the Roman Empire to completely fall? What was the year? Somebody say 473. There you go. It took that long for it to happen. But it happened. Just in the same fashion that God said that it would. Now, fear God. Give Him glory. For the hour is coming when He will judge man. Then we have a second angel in verse 8. And he goes around saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has made all nations to drink wine in the passion of her sexual immorality. In other words, this is the power that has taken hold of everything. And now it is about to fall. The great power of Rome is going to fall. The great city, the great evil, the great wickedness is about to come to its end. Then the third proclamation. It is a warning and an admonition. What does admonition mean? Not what you think it means. We've talked about this. When we admonish somebody, you know, we immediately think, oh, you're building them up. You're trying to make them think everything's right. You're being positive. That's not what admonition is. Admonition is direction. Instruction. Okay? If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark, he will drink the wine of the wrath of God. Now, this terminology is used because John's doing sort of like what Jesus did in all of his teachings. He's using elements that they understand. Okay? He's going to pour down his wrath on those who follow the beast and receives the mark of the beast. And again, people didn't walk around with 666 implanted in their heads or on their hand. It was those who had aligned themselves with the evil of Rome. And it says that he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone. Where will we find fire and brimstone? Pardon? In hell. Have we seen fire and brimstone in the past on earth? Where? Sodom and Gomorrah. Let me give you a little tidbit of history. Y'all won't remember this, but about 10 years ago, I ran an article in the Bulletin. Y'all may remember this. and I had a picture of brimstone. What is brimstone, by the way? Sulfur. Sulfur. In the area where archaeologists, I can't say that word right, think that Sodom and Gomorrah stood, in their diggings, they have found an unbelievable amount of pieces of sulfur. Some of them still intact in round balls the size of softballs. Now, they can't understand why in just these two places, which is surrounded by desert, you would find this much sulfur. Where did it come from? Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was the most fascinating thing, to go somewhere where you would never see stuff like this, and it's all piled up in two places, about 20 miles apart from one another, which is exactly what Sodom and Gomorrah was. They need proof, though, that God is real and that He actually exists. That's interesting. They will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends how long? Forever and ever. You know, we read the passages that talks about eternity and hell. We don't want to believe that, do we? As a matter of fact, some of y'all may remember, because I brought this out a couple of years ago, we had this nut. His name was Harold Camping. Anybody keep up with him? The guy that kept saying the world's going to come to an end on September 21st, you know? He tried twice a couple of years ago to predict the end of time, and then I kept up with him, and I'd listen to him every now and then, and he started talking about hell, and he said, you know, God is a merciful God. God is a loving God, and He's not going to let His people suffer long. He says when He throws the lost soul into hell, He's just going to go throwing into hell, and He's just going to vanish, and it's going to be as if He never existed. That's what hell is. That's not what this says. This says they're going to torment forever and ever, and the smoke, the visibility of that will be seen for an eternity. So this is pretty strong language, isn't it? He's warning the Christian, don't follow this beast, because this is the end result. Y'all watch the screen this morning during the lesson, and you may get a... If I can make it any more realistic, it'll be on screen this morning what I'm talking about right now. So y'all be sure and watch the screen this morning. Any questions on this? Okay. The third proclamation is also a word of wisdom. Keep the commandments of God and faith in Jesus. He is calling for the Christian to endure. You're going to have a lot of stuff thrown at you. We go back to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. And, you know, we're told, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Then that verse goes on to say, for you are going to experience what? Tribulation and trial. You're going to be tested beyond measure. Be sure that you endure. It's going to take patience. It's going to take strength. It's going to take conviction. It's going to take commitment. Be sure that you are able to do this. Because if you don't, go back to what I just said. This is the end result. Then this is one of the best verses in the Bible. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. For yea, says the Spirit, that they may have rest from their labors, and their works follow them. John is telling them that this is the end for the saint. They will be blessed because they have lived their lives for God. And if you can endure, if you can overcome this, then this is the end result. And that, to me, is the best verse in the Bible, because it tells us exactly what awaits for us if we can remain faithful to God. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay, we're going to stop here because we're going to take another turn here in verse 14. And I don't want to try to tackle that with 2 minutes left. So let's stop right here, and we will pick up with verse 14 next week.